My name's David Shepherd. I'm Director of Research for Arts and Humanities and Director of the Humanities Research Institute, or HRI, and it's my pleasure to welcome you all to this, the latest in our series of inaugural lectures that the HRI hosts. And one of the pleasures of my job is that I get to learn so much about the research that's being done by colleagues across the arts and humanities here at the university in the course of introducing these lectures and having the pleasure of sitting and listening to them. These are lectures that are intended to offer opportunities, as you all know, for recently appointed professors in the Arts and Humanities Division to spell out their vision for the development of their subject and bring the excellence of University of Sheffield research to the attention of a broad audience within and beyond the university. And it's with that audience beyond the university in mind that we routinely record these lectures and make them available on our website. Just one other formal feature of these lectures is that we tend not to interrogate the lecturers afterwards in a formal sense. There are no questions, but there is an opportunity to speak to the lecturer informally over a glass of wine afterwards, and I do hope you will join us for that after this evening's lecture. Now, this is the first time that I've had the pleasure of introducing an inaugural lecturer from my own department, Russian and Slavonic Studies. And in theory, of course, it should be a very straightforward matter for me to hymn the academic record and virtues of someone with whom I've been privileged to work closely for over a decade now. Indeed, at the risk of appearing to bask in reflected glory, I'm proud to recall that Neil Bommel's appointment to a lectureship in Czech language and linguistics, funded under a government initiative clumsily titled Former Soviet and East European Studies, or EFSIS, in 1996, was the first academic appointment that I oversaw as head of department. But lest familiarity should appear to have bred, if not contempt, then at best complacency, I felt that in the case of the now Professor Bommel, I should conduct the same kind of in-depth online research that I routinely employ for inaugural lecturers with whose careers I have been rather less immediately familiar. Now, the definition of in-depth online research, as the internet savvy among you will know, is simply going beyond the first page of Google Hits. And somewhere beyond those first few pages, replete as they were with references to Neil's publications and other academic activities, of which more anon, I came across the intriguing link, Bommel Neil, free express delivery. Who could resist following this? The result? Nothing. A blank page whose emptiness was fully certified by the appearance of the familiar message, done, in the bottom left corner of the browser window. Clearly this page had nothing to do with this evening's lecture. For express delivery of commitments and promises is one of Neil Bommel's hallmarks. This became apparent as soon as he was appointed back in 1996. As a US citizen, BA from Yale, MA, PhD from Berkeley, the gown never fails to draw gazes of wonderment at graduation ceremonies. As a US citizen, Neil required a work permit. I was rather pleased with myself, my own efficiency in getting the nod from the Home Office in just 2 weeks, only to discover that Neil had acted even more swiftly to secure the British passport to which he was entitled by virtue of British parentage. His scholarly progress and concomitant rise to the academic ranks were no less rapid. In 1997, just a year after he joined us, his first book, Context and the Lexicon in the Development of Russian Aspect, was published in the prestigious University of California Publications in Linguistics series, to glowing reviews. Now, the title of this book reminds us that Neil began life as a specialist in Russian linguistics. But what his departmental webpage describes with characteristic diffidence as, quote, the secondary interest that has gradually become my primary one, was already well established at that time. And in 2000, Lincom Europa published Register Variation and Language Standards in Czech. Thoroughly deserved promotion from lecturer straight to reader, duly followed in 2001. But there was no resting on laurels, and a series of publications on the processes of formal and informal regulation of language, and on corpus-based linguistics, and study of language usage in Czech, culminated last year in Linguistic Authority, Language Ideology, and Metaphor, the Czech Spelling Wars, published by Mouton de Gruyter. By the time of this book's appearance, Neil had already been promoted to his chair in Russian and Slavonic Studies. Clearly, the Britishness is not just in the passport, but in the blood, for you will have no doubt spotted that Neil's books were impeccably timed to fit with the census periods of the last two research assessment exercises. But Although he's performed to the highest possible levels as a researcher, Neil has not done so at the expense of other responsibilities. He's been a dedicated, inspirational teacher of Czech and Russian, skillfully piloting the introduction of Czech as a named subject in a number of degree programmes, and tactfully pushing a pedagogically rather conservative department towards the kind of innovative, communicative language teaching that is found in US universities. After all, he does still have his US passport. He's led two significant projects creating electronic resources for use in language teaching. His dual national affiliation, or should I say rather his truly international profile, has been reflected in his discharging of major responsibilities in a number of professional associations. The American Association of Teachers of Slavic and East European Languages, the British Association for Slavonic and East European Studies, and I have to say that it's to Neil Bermell's energetic efforts that BASIS owes the high profile that panels on language and linguistics now have in the programme of its annual conference. And there's also the International Association of Teachers of Czech. Neil serves on the editorial boards of two Czech linguistics journals and has well-established and fruitful collaborations with the Czech Academy of Sciences, to which he is a frequent visitor and from which we have the pleasure of receiving regular guests at the department. He's nurtured an excellent relationship between the department and the Czech Embassy in London. It's thanks to Neil's efforts that the Czech Embassy Prize is awarded annually for the best Level 3 performance in Czech language. And if the Czech Embassy continues to take a close interest in the health of Czech studies throughout the UK, then this is in large measure due to Neil Bermell's quiet diplomacy and tenacity. International and national activities haven't entailed neglect of the local. Neil has been actively involved in Sheffield's Czech and Slovak communities and has organised a lively Czech circle here in the university. Most recently, he's been prominent in the establishment of the Centre for Comparative Linguistic Research, a joint venture between the School of Modern Languages and Linguistics and the School of English. The University of Sheffield fully understands that a chair is scant reward for such strengths and achievements, and has duly recognised Neil Bermell's wide-ranging contribution by granting him the privilege of being head of the Department of Russian Islamic Studies for 4 years, beginning last autumn. Last autumn, or perhaps, in this instance, the American English term fall, might seem more appropriate. For Neil's introduction to this demanding post must have felt at times like a precipitous headlong tumble into the unknown. He's had to cope, inter alia, with the largely uncompensated loss of the experience and administrative capacity of two senior members of the department who cunningly timed their retirements to coincide with his assumption of new duties. Now, I too have been lost, but only in admiration for the equanimity with which Neil has coped with a succession of challenges that the last year has lobbed in his direction. But I do wonder whether he might have been at least in part prepared for this year's experiences by reading the kind of Czech fiction that, and this is yet another string to Neil's bow, he has in his time both translated and reviewed, although I don't think he's reviewed his own translations. What might Neil be referring to in the following sentences? I quote, "Nothing remains the same for more than a few moments. Time ebbs and flows in a sluggish tide. Characters dissolve into one another. Events occur, retreat, and reappear in different guises." End of quotation. No, this is not his personal statement for this year's staff review and development statement as head of school, but the opening paragraph of a New York Times review in May 2004 of Peter Esterhazy's postmodern novel Celestial Harmony. If Neil does retain, despite the turbulence of these last few months, some sense of enduring harmony, then I'm sure that in large measure this is due to the support of his partner Andy Swartz, whom it's a pleasure to welcome to this evening's lecture. And I hope that this event in itself, rooted as it is in some kind of tradition, might serve as a reminder that academic life does retain some kind of underlying stability, that there does remain space for scholarly pursuit. It's therefore my pleasure and honour now to invite an esteemed colleague, head of department and friend, to deliver his inaugural lecture on the subject Up an Orthographic Tree, Language Ideologies in Czech Spelling Reform. Professor Bo.
Thanks, David, for a celestial introduction. Obligatory PowerPoint. The subject that I'm talking about today comes from a project that really came to fruition about 18 months ago, and at the beginning of it, As with most research projects, it involved a lot of time spent in libraries, poring over old copies of newspapers and microfilms of newspapers. And every once in a while, through the kind of gray reams of text, you'd be rewarded with something like this, a cartoon to look at. And this cartoon by Vladimir Jiránek comes from Mladá fronta dnes, which is probably the Czech Republic's most widely read quality broadsheet. It dates from the 5th of August, 1994. And in it, we can see the head teacher reprimanding his teacher for being up a tree. And it's actually no wonder that she's up there. In 1993, 1 year earlier, she'd been handed a new spelling manual that was produced by the nation's official language institute. It contained new rules for the spelling of foreign words and capitalization, and she was told that starting in the autumn of 1994, this was what she would have to teach from. However, no sooner had it been published than there was a cry of outrage at the changes that it proposed. And as a result of these continuing arguments, the Ministry of Education yanked the certification that it had granted this manual and said that it needed a special explanatory addendum. The addendum was produced. It got mired in controversy as well. And then in mid-July 1994, 6 weeks before the start of the new school year, just as the addendum was ready to be published, the Ministry of Education called the whole venture off. They invalidated all the new textbooks that had been produced using the new guidelines and told teachers that they would have to go back to their old textbooks and their old syllabi. So at this point, as you can see, the teacher is just sort of hanging in there. She's waiting to see whether there's going to be another about face, another addendum to the existing addendum. And in fact, it turns out that there will be, just days before the start of the new school year. But for now, that's all in the future. And what we want to know now is what historical and linguistic forces conspired to drive her up that tree. So I'm going to talk just very briefly at the beginning about spelling reform and ideology in general. And then I'd like to talk a little bit about the history of spelling reform in Czech. Something like this is actually kind of hard to conceive of in English. We're probably a minority among European languages in having no official form of language regulation. And I'd like to sort of convince you that Czech might be an interesting test case to look at for things like this. And then I'd like to go on and talk a little bit about linguistics and ideology. First, I'll take linguists as the group and what I'm calling the view from above. And this will primarily be a look at the linguistic school called Prague Functionalism and the way that it's interacted with language regulation. And then I'm going to turn to the public and what I'll call the view from below, and talk about the public's relationship with spelling reform, both involving kind of the historical factors and also their use of metaphorical language. So to start with spelling reform and ideology. Spelling reform, basically, we can kind of break it down into two parts. And the first part is simply attempts to define how certain words should be spelled. For instance, how spelling rules should apply to individual lexemes and to kind of entire clusters of lexemes. And this is called corpus planning in the field. More generally, we can also look at how these sorts of changes should be implemented. So we can look at what sorts of communicative situations or texts we expect spelling rules should be applied to. We can look at the extent to which they should be binding. And these sorts of issues generally come within the package of what's called status planning, using British pronunciation. So when I talk about ideology again, because this is one of these words that gets bandied about quite a bit, it's useful to define what we mean. And I'm just going to take Richard Watts's definition for now, which is that linguistic ideology is a set of beliefs about the structure of language and or the functional usage to which a language is put, which are shared by the members of a community. And community is a very useful word there, because we might be talking about the whole linguistic community, all speakers of the language, or we might be talking about kind of particular groups, interest groups, if you like, or affiliational groups within that. So we might, for instance, be saying that linguists, people whose profession has to do with language and regulation of language, have certain or we might say that the public, in other words, if you like, naive users of the language, have certain ideologies. So turning from there to the history of spelling reform in Czech, I'll talk just a bit about the geography of it, take you through kind of a potted history of Czech language regulation, and then talk a little bit about the interaction of purism and nationalism in the Czech context. Czech is actually a fairly simple language situation in some ways. We're dealing with a monolingual, monoethnic polity in Central Europe, about 10.5 million of them. They live right there. 94% of them in a recent census define themselves as being Czech. Most of the rest of them define themselves in various other ways, such as Moravian or Silesian, which are basically, many would consider, subgroups of Czech. It's a West Slavonic language, so it's mutually intelligible with Slovak after 70 years of coexistence in a common state that's now come to a close, and somewhat more distantly related to Polish, even further from Russian and other Slavonic languages. But these relationships have played a role in the way that Czechs have regulated their language, and I'll get to that later. I'm only going to go back as far, you'll be relieved to know, as far as the period of what's called the National Revival, which starts in roughly around 1790 and continues up through at least 1850 in its earliest phases and then beyond. And at this earliest point, 1790, the Czech lands are part of a centralized Austrian state. They've been so for over 150 years, and in that state, German has largely supplanted Czech as the standard language. So this national revival, which of course is happening in other places around Europe as well, in the Czech lands takes the form of trying to describe and systematize a variety that was called humanist Czech, which is essentially the written Czech of the 16th century. And this was generally revered as the pinnacle of Czech literary achievement. So it doesn't begin as an attempt to create a usable standard. And in fact, the Dobrovský, who's probably the most widely known and admired figure of the period, is at first writing and describing humanist Czech primarily in German. When the first dictionary of Czech is published, the first major dictionary by Jungmann, that's not a monolingual dictionary. It's a translating dictionary between Czech and German. So we're really working against the background in the earliest years of a German-speaking state. And it's the Czech revivalists are attempting to define themselves in a way against this. Now, later on, it does develop into a full-fledged nationalist movement that's trying to revive and spread the use of this particular variety of Czech as a standard. And it does catch on. It spreads across the Czech lands. But the point here is that from the beginnings of modern Czech, this is a language that's built on a strong tradition of imposing standards from above, rather than relying necessarily on usage and practice. And this comes out of the fact that phonologically, this variety that they were describing and later using is quite different from spoken Czech of the early 19th century. Morphologically and lexically, it's very conservative as well, because for obvious reasons, it just doesn't acknowledge many of the borrowings that would have taken place from German in the intervening years, or even many of the changes that had taken place from the 16th century to the 19th century in verbal and nominal morphology, for example. So they are looking at trying to impose a variety for usage that's very different from what would have been heard and even what was used in informal and slightly more formal communication up till that point. So by the mid-19th century, this revived version of Czech is pretty well established as a written standard. And the focus of the nationalist movement within Czech linguistics shifts from simply encouraging the use of Czech to trying to ensure that people use good, correct, and pure Czech. And the symbol of this effort becomes the knife grinder, the knife, and the whetstone. And this is curious. Linguist George Thomas says that the image of the whetstone is uniquely Czech. It doesn't seem to be found in any other language regulation tradition. And it dates from 1667, from a well-known, fairly purist grammar by Jiří Konstanz called The Whetstone of the Czech Language. So this is sort of his extended conceit. He says the language is a knife. It's our instrument. And the language user is a knife grinder. And he needs, therefore, a tool to sharpen his knife, to make it better. And the tool is the grammar book. So that's what he's providing you with, and that's why he calls it a whetstone. And in 1870, the Czech Foundation, which was at the time one of the most influential and powerful publishers of books relating to Czech, said that it was time for a new whetstone of the Czech language, which they would sponsor. Now, interestingly enough, in this period, when people talk about the knife grinder, they no longer mean the ordinary language user. They no longer mean that you take this whetstone and you improve your own language. The knife grinder is said to be the linguist who writes the book. So it's a slight shift there in emphasis. And this next period, from 1870 into the early 1900s, is really the era of the whetstone. And we see manual after manual of various either practical or possibly not so practical orientations that are attempting to instill a properly purist approach to the language, to get people to do things like avoid foreign words, especially those from German. German's especially bad. And to propagate their own archaic or invented terms. So to sum up, throughout the 19th century and even into the 20th century, language regulation largely revolves around unofficial attempts to purify the language and return it to a mythical, earlier uncontaminated state. And as time goes on, these efforts become less and less grounded in the reality of what that language had been, and more grounded in the individual preferences of these self-appointed reformers. So, with all these unofficial language regulators running around, it's not surprising that there arises a movement in the late 19th century to settle on an agreed list of variants for use in what was a growing Czech educational sector. Now, interestingly enough, purists didn't necessarily condemn these attempts to standardize Czech spelling. Many of the linguistic purists, who were very deeply conservative about the language's lexicon and grammar, were often very keen to propose changes to spelling. And this was on the grounds that clarity and consistency, they said, were more important so that people could focus on the more important matter of rooting out all the Germanisms in their speech. So we get the first edition of this in 1902. It is put together by a commission that was appointed by the Austrian Education Ministry. And traditionally, this was headed by reasonably highly regarded Czech linguists. The first one is Jan Gebauer, for those of you who do that means anything. Extremely well-known and well-respected. It was to be obligatory for use in schools in the Czech lands, and the decisions that were made and that proved controversial in it centered mainly on the spelling of native words. And this is important because as we see further editions, and you can see there are further editions roughly every 10 to 15 years, that the focus shifts to that of borrowed words. And in particular, the use of what was called etymological S versus phonemic Z. Just a small excursus on this. This is because words that you get from Latin or Greek tend to have come into Czech very often via German. In German, as we know, very often the letter S represents the sound Z. This tends to come into Czech as well. And this creates a problem because once you get into Czech, the letter S tends to stand for the sound S. So either people hear a word and they're not sure how to write it, or they see a word and they're not sure how to spell it, because they've got this clashing tradition between the Czech and the German. So later editions of this book are primarily concerned, in fact, you could even say obsessed, with this particular question of using S and Z and where it's written. Whoops, sorry, I'm going backwards. So this brings us to the topic of Prague functionalism. And Prague functionalism is a school of linguistic thought, and it's important because it proposes a complete overhaul of the way language was looked at in the Czech lands. And it's propagating a successful alternative to purist models of language regulation. It's had an incredibly long life in the Czech lands. It spanned three political systems, from the democracy of the First Republic through to communism, back to post-communism now, post-communist democracy, and inevitably, to a certain extent, its entanglement with these political systems has had an effect on how language reform was carried out. So So if we look at, here's the Prague linguistic circle, if you like, and two tenets of it that we can kind of focus on. The first one, that language is a system of purposeful means of expression. And these two quotes come from the theses of the Prague linguistic circle. And the second one is that the goal of analysis is to uncover the structural laws of linguistic systems and their development. So this Prague linguistic circle, which was sort of a meeting of more or less like-minded souls in the 1920s, develops eventually into two independent angles of investigation, one of which we call functionalism, this idea of focusing your investigations around the idea of purpose, and the second, structuralism, the idea of looking at structures into which things fall. Functionalism ends up being more important for our purposes because for various reasons, structuralism reaches a dead end in Czechoslovakia and has somewhat limited influence there. Its primary development is elsewhere. So what brought the functionalists with this interest in function to language regulation? Well, Wilhelm Matthesius, who was considered by most people to be the founder of the Prague school, felt that purism and a certain autocratic mentality in the linguistics community had led to a situation where changes in orthography were made frequently and rather haphazardly. So he wasn't against regulation at all. He simply wanted to put it on what he considered to be a rigorous logical basis. And you can see here, his point is, he says, the surface of our standard language is constantly, pointlessly rippling, and our linguistic intuition is undermined. So this logical basis that he wants is going to be, of course, modern linguistics, and in his view, functionalism. This would create the conditions for a more usable standard language. And he talks here, in this quote, a little bit about how various languages have used, have accomplished language regulation. Some of them, as he points out, and this is true to a certain extent in Czech, have relied on authorial practice. In Czech, this was called the notion of the good author. And what Matthesius said about it is, these forces suffice to form and refine the majority of standard languages that arose before the 19th century. And these are, in fact, the most refined languages in the world. But the current state of linguistic theory, he says, enables us to accelerate the process of refinement a bit through scholarly intervention. And then he gives a slight excuse for this and says, in any way, the current position of standard Czech is rather different from that of the great cultural languages at the time of their refining. So what were the functionalists' criteria for a functional standard language? Well, as you can see, they believe that orthography should be easy and clear, so far as its functional visual distinction permits. And they said that changing orthographic conventions, especially if it does not contribute to simplification, goes against the need for stability. Contradictions between the orthography of native words and the orthography of foreign words should be removed, at least where they lead to confusion in pronunciation. And here we get, again, this obsession. For instance, in Czech orthography, S in foreign words has the value of both S and Z. So notice that parts of this are a change from purist doctrine, and parts are not, because ease and clarity were always there, and now we're still talking about ease and clarity. Stability, again, we can see stability in some of what that quote that I showed you previously from Athesius. This later gets modified slightly into a concept that the functionalists called flexible stability. In other words, sometimes by making changes, you can bring a system into a state of greater stability. A bit of tension here. But that's all I want to say about that for the moment. So if we try to get an overall view of what functionalists wanted, they wanted functionalist language regulation to be based on scientific, objective linguistic study. And by that, they meant they wanted to study what people actually do and what their communicative needs are. And they felt that if you did this, regulation would march in step with the natural evolution of language. And finally, they thought that language had to be viewed first and foremost, not as something aesthetic, but as a tool of human communication. Now, there are some ideological assumptions that are hidden here. The first is that linguistic research is objective and scientific by its nature. And they really did kind of just shove to one side any notion that that you interpret when you're a linguist at all. So any subjective component to this was just sort of kind of pushed into a corner a bit. Even in Mathesius's rather well-founded rebukes to the purists, we see interpretation. So it wasn't entirely kosher of them to do this. Second, there's this we have this strong focus on function rather than the user. And this is crucial because it does help us to explain fundamental differences between written language and spoken language. And when we define these functions, we can naturally, for instance, restrict language regulation, for instance, to the sphere of writing, which is what the functionalists in many instances wanted to do. So it gets away from the whole idea that you necessarily have to kind of correct the way people speak when they talk to each other informally. And that was an important move forward in the Czech context. But it also kind of assumes that when you do research on one particular social or occupational group, that it's more or less good enough to apply to all social and occupational groups. So there's no overt admission there that different groups might react differently to changes, at least at first. And this focus on the communicative needs of the producer kind of dampens down any aesthetic component to language regulation. So there's little attempt to take into the view of, to take into account the view of the person who's listening on any level other than, well, did you or didn't you understand what this person was trying to say? The whole idea of the tool of human communication as a metaphor really underscores this strong instrumental orientation. As you'll probably have noticed, it co-opts this very well-worn Czech image of the knife grinder, the knife, and the whetstone, but it gives them a slightly different twist, because in the original puristic image, the grinder is using the whetstone to produce a finer, keener product. But by de-emphasizing the shape of the tool, the aesthetics of the tool, and focusing on its purpose, the functionalists are reorienting the debate around the question of what language does, as opposed to what it looks like. In other words, a knife isn't good simply because it has an excellent knife-like shape. We judge it by how well it cuts. So, moving on a little bit in history, in 1946, we see the Czech Dictionary Office and the Spelling Commission absorbed into a new Czech language institute. And this language institute has a much broader remit than either of the two previous bodies did. It has a public advice service, it runs radio programs and newspaper columns, it chairs terminological commissions, it's responsible for various other linguistic manuals, they take charge of many of the linguistic journals published in the country. They conduct research into the history of the language. Interestingly enough, they're also said to be responsible for the linguistic editing of political documents. And this is the realization of a long-held dream of both the purists and the functionalists. So they finally get a fully-fledged language institute with strong persuasive powers. Notice no legal powers. There's no provision for this in the Czech constitution, none in the Czech laws, none in the bylaws of the institute. The legal right to say what gets used where rests with various other bodies. But interestingly enough, we can chart the rise of the functionalists by seeing that the top posts in this institute go in the first instance to functionalist language. So this really marks their ascent. At the same time, political events are sort of overtaking this. In 1946, the communists gain a plurality in parliament in the first post-war elections. They form a government after protracted negotiation that went on throughout the war. And then a coup in February 1948, often called Victorious February in those days, consolidates power permanently in the hands of the Communist Party and their allies. Now, there were several committed socialists among the top functionalists, and some people have said, ascribed at least part of functionalist success to this fact. Structuralism falls out of the picture here, partially because it's a very formal discipline and doesn't seem to have much social relevance, and also because one of its primary exponents, Jakobsen, flees the country is widely reviled. It sort of really puts the lid on structuralism for at least 10 years in Czechoslovakia. So an inevitable question then is whether functionalism was one of those movements that prospered because it, as they said back then, went with the times, or whether it somehow managed to prosper in spite of them. Now, there were reforms in 1957. These were primarily produced by linguists, and when they put together their proposals, they consulted, as they said, with other users of the standard language. And if you read kind of more to find out who those users of the standard language are, they're not, you know, peasants learning how to write or factory workers. They're journalists, they're academics, they're editors, they're all the usual suspects. However, that said, there was a strong attempt to try to keep party officials on board. So you see František Váha, who was the lead academic on the rules, said, yes, of course, responsible political places must play a role in decision-making and ratification. And there were also strong attempts to appeal to the populist nature of these reforms. And again, here's another quote from Vahala, kind of in the build-up to the reforms, 1952. With the scientificization of working methods, with the penetration of specialist literature into the broadest masses of our workers, with the governing of daily life according to the scientific laws of historical and dialectical materialism, many words that were previously truly narrowly specialized have now become the common property of the whole of socialist society. Now, you may wonder what this is all about. This is about taking words where you used to spell F, you used to spell it with an S, and putting a Z there. Another point with this, they used it. They used the convergence of Czech and Slovak orthography as another reason. And again, this is because you have two languages coexisting in a single state. This is not an innovation of the communist period, because this tendency has been there ever since the formation of the republic. But we start to see things like the harmonious coexistence of two fraternal nations in a common state. So these sort of with this slight kind of socialist brotherhood gloss on it now that there hadn't been before. Now, despite all of this, we see that in these 1957 reforms, some words were rejected for change. And so if you look up the words president, universita, communismus, philosophia, or gymnasium, although in each case that S is spelled, is pronounced as a Z, philosophia is a slightly touchy example there, you might ask, well, why didn't these, as long as they were changing so many other words, why didn't they change these? And according to Alexander Stich, who was a prominent reformer, he said that the chief state ideologue, Václav Kopečný, had himself sort of stepped in to block these changes, and specifically these words, because he thought they were sort of too elevated to warrant the use of this sort of newfound Z. So this shows that the proletarian leaders were somewhat more conservative and mistrustful of change than their linguistic colleagues. And linguistics, František Danish has made this point several times and quite emphatically. The linguists claimed that they had always had their own agenda and that cooperation with political authorities had simply been an unpleasant necessity to make sure their work continued. And he, in fact, said that they brought more chaos into the change than they did with positive contributions. So then we get kind of a period of relative stasis. From 1958 through to the early 1990s, virtually nothing happens. And this is a bit strange, considering that previously there had been a reform every 10 to 15 years. So orthographic commissions continue to sit, but they're disbanded without ever reaching a final proposal. And according to Tsvrček, this stasis masks ongoing disagreements between people who wanted a really radical reform and people who thought that really wouldn't fly. There was an attempt, apparently, in 1983 to propose a very radical reform, which would have affected possibly maybe between one and four words in 10 quite significant. That apparently was blocked by none other than Gustav Husak, the General Secretary of the Communist Party. So these people clearly were interested in what was going on in the Muslims. Finally, eventually, in 1998, a much smaller reform that affected mainly the use of S and Z and vowel length and borrowed words and capitalization, just a few other points, affects maybe one word in every 100, not a radical change, is put forward. Consultations on this were rather limited. There was a so-called white book produced, which was essentially a draft of the rules, and this was sent, according to published sources, to about 30 institutions, primarily universities. So again, they're not consulting extremely widely with the proletarian masses. They're consulting with their equals. Finally, in 1993, after the fall of communism, the rules in fact come out, and it's instructive to read this bit from the cover, where we can learn that since 1957, a considerable number of orthographic problems have accumulated, and the public has expected or even directly demanded solutions to them. These new rules eliminate extraneous exceptions, simplify certain overcomplicated orthographic rules, eliminate contradictions that exist in the current rules or have arisen in daily language use. In recent years, the authors went on, our understanding of Czech pronunciation has deepened, and therefore its codification has changed in various points. This has also influenced decision on graphic shape, especially for words of foreign origin. So, the public is indirectly demanding help to make the rules more logical and easy to use. Again, these echoes of going all the way back to the 19th century. This doesn't mean that the public is asking for change. Instead, they're asking for the mediation of the wise linguist. He's going to step in, he'll use his observations and analyses to show them what is needed and feasible. And this will create the conditions for objective and useful intervention. It posits the existence of problems in orthography that push us towards intervention. Existing guidelines, they say, they're too complex or they're self-contradictory. Usage has moved on, and the new state of affairs simply isn't reflected in them. And these discrepancies are said to be problems that accumulate. And as a functionalist, you really can't ignore this, because defects in the system are going to show up somehow as functional gaps that are going to impede effective use of the language. The final point being advances in linguistics that are nudging people towards intervention. So the functionalist planner then uses this knowledge, newly gained knowledge, to improve the effectiveness of his language by manipulating and guiding the standard into a closer approximation of his new understanding. So, we've got these things, they're called rules. Are they rules or are they laws? Now, this was a big matter for debate. And you can see it being balanced in different statements. If you look at the foreword to these rules, you'll see the following. We treat orthographic rules as a state of recommendations or sophisticated written expression from which it is permissible to deviate in special instances, should the writer deem it necessary and justified. Again, this is from an institute that has no legal ability to enforce these things. Or another quote from František Dámeš, who was a strong supporter of these rules, and he phrased it slightly differently. He said, we start with the fact that every sensible person recognizes that it's good to have a single way of writing. There is no language police. No one can be tried for not respecting the rules. He can, however, be condemned by society. And I suspect he meant this in a humorous way. But you see there's this balancing act going on between requirement and recommendation. And couched in this sort of softer language is the threat that if you ignore these rules, you'll be perceived as insufficiently sophisticated, or you'll find yourselves ostracized by mainstream users of the language. And I think this was their way of balancing between the fact that they didn't really have the right to impose these anywhere except in the schools. But they really wanted other people to take it on board. They realized that if people didn't, there would be chaos. So, how do we do objective linguistics? I've talked about objective linguistics. Well, the first thing is obviously we want to avoid aesthetic judgments and opinions. These aren't objective. They're emotional or they're idiosyncratic, and they lead to this kind of purism of a self-appointed elite, which is where the checks had come from originally. So when the authors of the rules were asked about this, they said, well, we observe actual language and we analyze it, and various techniques for this. You can use excerption, which in the early 1990s, where you just go through books, you go through newspapers, and you write out the examples that interest you. You could do controlled linguistic studies. These were frequently done with pronunciation. Or you could look for evidence of errors. And this is a quite interesting one. Because they often said, when they were asked for examples, they said, well, for instance, if you look at greengrocer signs, people often misspell the following sets of words. And once you've got that, then you propose resolutions that address these problems that you found, that minimize the difference between spoken and written norms to the extent that you judge it to be feasible, and thus lower barriers to writing and reading. So, greengrocer signs, I saw Eva laugh there. It took me about 2 minutes to get here. I Googled misplaced apostrophe, and within 2 minutes I was on the grocer's apostrophe Flickr page. And so the question is, once we've got sofa apostrophe S, haggis samosas, deep fried Oreos, flats, and I think that's shades, does that lead us, if we were operating under these sorts of rules, would that mean that we'd be studying this phenomenon and then allowing apostrophes to be placed before the plural endings of nouns, or maybe the special rule for the plural endings of nouns ending in vowels? So, questions that all of this leaves us with. Are the habits of proficient users somehow less linguistically significant than those of non-proficient users, which is what something like this would tend to suggest? And second, if data from non-proficient writers are so crucial to understanding how the standard is evolving, why are these users never directly consulted? Or they are, they're consulted, but only in school children are consulted. They're tested. They're tested, but they're never consulted. And third of all, problems like this can prove to you that there is room for reform of the language, but it doesn't necessarily prove to you that there is also a need for reform. And this, I think, was one of the tensions that surrounded the whole debate, which we're coming to now. So I'm going to touch on just a couple of points quickly here at the end about the public's response to language regulation. First, I'll talk about the aesthetic dimension of regulation, which, as we said, tends to get left out of the linguistic approach. I'll talk a little bit about the historical context of the early 1990s, and then talk about how metaphoric argument facilitated the public's response. So first of all, the aesthetic dimension. You can notice everywhere, and once when you start looking at what the public said about this, their primary reaction is always to do with how they felt about this. And if you look at this first quote here, we opened our new edition of the rules, and immediately our hearts began to race. But no longer did our old familiar pulse quicken. In its place was a repulsive buzzing pulse. Or the following one. These linguists have legalized that Z, a fact I can only describe with the obviously highly subjective word, yuck. In Czech, I think that's fui. It looks awful and sounds even worse. So people were very keen to bring this subjective dimension, the dimension of the receiver, the recipient of language, back into the debate. A second issue is historical, historical fears that were brought into this. The early 1990s were a time of major transition. The Czechs felt themselves somewhere caught between East and West, and spelling conventions became a sign of this. Foreign words, especially, were this kind of overhyped symbol of affiliation to one camp or the other. There's a traditional, kind of more Slavonic model, where you adapt spelling to local pronunciation conventions. And this was denigrated as being primitive and non-Western, associated with things like Sovietization, proletarianization of culture. The general lack of this approach in Western European languages became a kind of a symbol of resistance to the old Soviet order. And this is one of my favorite quotes. Across the whole of Europe, from the Baltic to the Adriatic, there has descended an iron curtain of transcription from the Greek and Latin languages, that thesaurus of European thinking. It's just absolutely brilliant. but at any rate, this is not uncharacteristic of the level of discussion and debate. And you can see how how much these things mattered to people at the time. I'm going to finish up by talking a little bit about metaphors, and just an easy definition for you from Lakoff and Johnson, probably the most widely read work on this subject, which is that metaphor is simply understanding and experiencing one kind of thing in terms of another. Why put it in this talk? Well, metaphors are convenient mental shortcuts that encapsulate for us a series of structural references, if you like, almost emotional baggage. And when we use a metaphor, we're not just calling on a simple physical similarity. Instead, the target of that metaphor takes on a raft of other features that are entailed by the use of that particular source. And their first example is argument is war. They always write it with caps. That seems to have become more or less a tradition in this field. So the argument is your target, and it draws on the source domain of war. So this is why we see frequent instantiations of this are that you win or lose an argument, you attack someone in an argument, you defend a position. So it's all language sort of drawn from that source domain of war. What I did was, over the years, I accumulated about 550 articles from the Czech press of that period, between 1990 and 1995 or so. I excerpted the metaphors from them, got about 650 distinct usages there, and classified and analyzed the results. Now, interestingly enough, language planners are quite conscious in their use of metaphor. For them, it's an explanatory device that's used to support other methods of argumentation. But for non-specialists, metaphor is often the primary method of explanation and argumentation. And you can see that in that Iron Curtain metaphor above. Nerlich talks, in fact, about this. She says that people use metaphors to exert a degree of imaginary control over a threatening world. And I think that's exactly what we're seeing. So the three metaphors I'm going to just take you briefly through are that language is a person, that regulation of language is a path or journey, and that language is a tool. So I'm sorry, these get kind of small here. But language is a person, relatively rich metaphor, lots you can do with it. And this shows up an awful lot. For instance, we learn that language has a spirit of language. It has a deadened body. Has a blood pulse. We have an emotional and ethical relationship to it. We can muzzle the language, so it must have a voice. Languages can cope with things, or they can resolve situations. Language can be described as a child that had an unnatural birth. It can also be a child in diapers, apparently. Later on, it might die, or it might merely be sleeping. We can commit violence against language, and the language can even weep. I mean, this was an extremely rich vein to mine here. And these metaphors lead us to the conclusion that regulation causes harm. It's immoral based on natural law. Why? Because we shouldn't tolerate violence against a defenseless, sentient, living being. We shouldn't make people cry. Actions that cause the death of a human being are evil. If we have a relationship with someone and respect them, then they need to be treated as our equal. A person has a right to grow or develop as he desires, and attempts to forcibly change or dominate another person are wrong. If you're a proponent of language regulation, you typically don't call language a person. You call it a plant, and you talk about pruning it and things like that, but that's another story. Another very common metaphor was to say that language regulation is somehow a path or a journey. And sometimes we just say, yeah, it's a path. Sometimes we say it's a path somewhere. That's always very fruitful. You can call it a path to implement primitivism, a shift unambiguously toward the East, creeping Bolshevization of the language on its path towards a rupture with the traditions of European civilization, or a slight modification of this. You can talk about appeasing, essentially, and in Czech, the word appease and to meet partway can be the same, like vstříc. So path metaphors are interesting because regulation, of course, is a process. It occurs over time, and it has a history. When we transform history into physical space, again, a very common thing to do in metaphors, the metaphors open up the possibility of returning back along that path, so nothing's irrevocable. You can return, you can revisit places you've already passed through. So path metaphors are very attractive if what you want to do is abandon reforms. because all you need to do then is backtrack, and you've restored the status quo. Another very common metaphor is that which suggests that language is a tool. So here you've got one where we say that language somehow molds itself like a piece of clay spinning on a potter's wheel, possibly becoming a nice wired pot like this one here. But then you can add other metaphors to that. For instance, you can ask, perhaps it's a tool for human communication, like that metaphor of the functionalist that we saw before. And here's one person saying, spelling rules are like a notepad and pencil, like a typewriter, a computer, or a tape recorder. Remember, this is the early 1990s. Or it might be a tool of logic and progress. So one person, for instance, suggests that language is directed by logic that can be mathematically expressed and analyzed on a computer. So perhaps then language is an improved tool. Regulation can help us improve it. Or possibly, it might be a language honed by whetstone-toting purists, these champions of the classical form of Czech with a slightly Renaissance air about them. It might be a tool formed by ideologues and factory bosses. And here we see things about, for instance, the attempt at linguistic engineering that hits you right beyond, between the eyes. I'll stop at this linguistic engineering business. Those of you who are Russianists will immediately recognize this, right? Because in the 1930s, Stalin draws a parallel between scientific engineers and people that he calls engineers of the human soul. Zhdanov and Goyki then take this up at the Writers' Conference in 1934, and they apply this term to writers, saying that writers should take up this new party-approved line and adhere to the newly minted artistic movement of socialist realism, art in the service of socialist goals. So, 1948, of course, this gets ported across to socialist Czechoslovakia, where it becomes the official artistic movement eventually there as well. And this metaphor of the engineer of human souls is then easily applied to linguists. And this is what happens in the orthography debate. So it turns out that any metaphors having to do with science or progress or engineering are double-edged. They may invoke views of sort of dispassionate study, but they could also end up recalling language purism and totalitarianism. Here, my favorite quote from this, I think, comes from the agriculture minister, who was quoted in an article, again, talking about the spelling rules being imposed in school. I would be glad if as little experimenting as possible was done on children. So again, the slightly negative use, the idea that language might not be an improved tool because of these reforms, but instead it might be a deformed tool. So metaphors have influenced these debates. They've influenced their logic, their political significance, and the extent of their cultural specificity. We've seen that they're sort of shortcuts for lengthy explanations, but because no shortcut is a perfect match, the structures that they impose can have a subtle or not so subtle impact on the debate. Sometimes they oversimplify the solution, so they talk about a path as being a physical place. Or they add a level of complexity that wasn't there, for instance, when they relate the issue to previous debates. So we can ask whether the engineer is a good engineer or is he a bad engineer? Is he a good scientist like Mathesius or is he a bad scientist, someone like Nicolai Marr? And metaphors can be pressed into political service as well. So in this whole debate, they turn out to be a very powerful weapon. They tend to mobilize opinion against the proposed changes. They tend to be used to label the reformers as crypto-communists or anti-Western. And as Nerlich says, they tap into a nation's cultural imagination. They reinforce stereotypes, and in doing so, they shape social policy. Now, if these metaphors betray certain naive ideological assumptions about language regulation, then the scholarly approaches that dominated Czech linguistics weren't free of ideology either. Functionalism proved to be an interesting example precisely because it was a progressive linguistic school, but one that also became inextricably linked with some of the political trends of past eras. In addition, its own ideological biases limited its view of language planning and provided an opening for attacks on it. So we've had a look at what drove this poor teacher here up a tree, both metaphorically and literally. And we've also had a look around the roots of this conflict. If you're curious what eventually happened, eventually the various parties did reach an agreement on an addendum to the addendum that revised the rules, and it was all published and shipped out to schools with only days to spare before the start of the 1994 school year. Now, not that this new addendum to the addendum was without problems. Lots of people found it infinitely more complex than the original revision, and that unleashed a whole new round of problems. And in this cartoon by Zdeněk Hofmann, you can see on the left here, we've got, these are the original rules, and here's the addendum. It's rather large. Even now, 15 years later, there hasn't been, we can't write the final chapter to this whole conflict. There's still a fair amount of confusion and uncertainty as to what you can write, or what you should write, or what you ought to write, where. And the only thing I can leave you with is to say that this controversy remains, for now, up in the air. Thank you.